Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and the Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School in Isabella, Missouri. And the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5, 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network, and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and the Gordon Law School, please visit my website. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Calamity Howler, a publication put out by A.V. Krebs on Rocky Flats' nuclear weapons plant. You can get a copy of the Calamity Howler, that's spelled H-O-W-L-E-R. Sometimes, Krebs says, an intended epithet can be turned to good advantage. In the sole surviving issue of the Decatur, Texas Times, one finds the way populists not only accepted the label Calamity Howler, but insisted that they had ample reason to howl and would continue to howl until their objectives had been attained. Published by The Populist Mind, edited by Norman Pollock. The Calamity Howler is published weekly by A.V. Krebs. You can have a free copy, or a free subscription, I should say, by way of email. And just go to avkrebs at earthlink.net. That's A-V-K-R-E-B-S at earthlink.net. To receive, just send your name and address. I suggest a donation. It's not a subscription price, but a donation of $10 a month, $120 a year to weekly publication. Here's the lead article in the Calamity Howler. Outrage is admittedly the most common emotion that one feels after reading a 280-page book titled The Ambushed Grand Jury, published by Apex Press. However, one also experiences practically every other human emotion, frustration, anger, sadness, joy, empathy, and admiration of the human spirit, as authors Karen Balcony and Colorado cowboy Wes McKinley reveal how the U.S. Department of Justice has covered up government nuclear crimes at Colorado's Rocky Flats nuclear weapons plant and how a band of persevering individuals courageously caught the government red-handed. Here's the story. They're riveting. The story is not just about Balcony, an anti-nuclear activist and volunteer lawyer, and McKinley, who served 3 years as the foreman of a special grand jury convened back in 1989 to hear charges of nuclear crimes by the U.S. government and its defense contractor, Rockwell International. And it's also about a courageous whistleblower and a former plutonium plant employee, Jacques Brever, and an FBI agent, John Lipsky, who saw years of hard work investigating environmental criminality undermined by his own superiors and the U.S. government. Throughout the book, the reader is shown evidence of how the U.S. government and its defense contractors covered up dangerous environmental wrongdoing at Rocky Flats, suppressed the indictments demanded by a federal grand jury, and threatened those jurors with jail if they spoke out concerning their findings. Rocky Flats, where the triggers for America's nuclear arsenal were made, lies only 16 miles upwind from Denver, Colorado, and it has the reputation of being one of the most contaminated nuclear facilities in the nation, although its production facilities have been closed since 1992. Unwilling to accept being made victims, it was through McKinley's sense of justice and Balcani's initial investigative efforts that a citizen's grand jury investigation was launched and still is enlisting support of citizen grand jurors to consider all of the facts laid out meticulously in a 43-page appendix, 36 pages of which are textual footnotes, and then render their decision in the court of public opinion and before Congress. The ambushed grand jury, which details their citizen's investigation and additional information, can be obtained online at www.ambushedgrandjury.com. The authors are donating their profits to Nuclear Watchdog and environmental groups around the country. In the book, the citizen's grand jury recounts how Lipsky, the FBI agent, after years of methodical preparation and investigation, led a historic 1989 FBI raid on the Rocky Flats plant, the first time the Bureau ever served a search warrant on the United States government, only to see the U.S. Justice Department sell out his case. Lipsky believes the Justice Department ordered him to lie about what had happened with the criminal investigation. Outraged, Special Agent Lipsky instead joined the citizens' investigation to help uncover the secrets of Rocky Flats. And it also tells the story of Brever, who blew the whistle on repeated safety violations and secret illegal midnight plutonium burning at Rocky Flats after the facility had been ordered to shut down. Subsequently, in 1989, she maintained someone tried to kill her by intentionally contaminating her with deadly radioactivity to stop her from testifying before the special federal grand jury. She testified anyway. Now, despite her expert testimony, the government sabotaged her 2 days of testimony by claiming that she was not a very reliable source. Distraught and fearful of the continuing assaults on her and her young daughter, she fled Colorado and disappeared for almost 10 years. Yet, in failing health and still fearful of the dangers that almost killed her, she eventually came out of hiding to join the Citizens Grand Jury investigation. Today, she is undergoing treatment for thyroid cancer and has started United to Keep Rocky Flats Closed. It's a Colorado-based informational program dedicated to stopping government efforts to convert the highly contaminated 6,500-acre Rocky Flats Reservation into a national wildlife refuge with horseback riding, hiking, and children's school trips. The other key hero in this tale of how the U.S. government has held the health of an unsuspecting public hostage in the name of corporate greed, at the same time bilking the nation's taxpayers of millions of dollars and attempting to discredit those patriots who sought to expose their corrupt practices. One such is Wes McKinley. Foreman of the 1989 to 1992 federal grand jury that sought to investigate the insidious relationship between the U.S. Department of Energy and Rockwell International, he saw the U.S. Justice Department ambushed his 23-member panel and sealed a grand jury report detailing the evidence of alleged nuclear crimes and lethal combination, in addition to threatening those same jurors with prison if they talked about it. He also witnessed the Justice Department lies to the grand jury, Congress, and the public about what the Energy Department and Rockwell Alliance, or Rockwell International and their alliance, had really been doing at the Rocky Flats Test Reservation. Described as patriotic and law-abiding as they come, who never had even so much as a traffic ticket, McKinley, despite being under investigation by the FBI since 1992, now that's 12 years, has sought to try and find ways to warn the Congress and the public about the dangers that he and his fellow grand jurors uncovered in their 3 years of hearings on the Rocky Flats testimony. He has twice run unsuccessfully for Congress, hoping to use congressional immunity to reveal what truly happened with the grand jury. He's running again in 2004. Otherwise, grand jury secrecy rules prevent him from talking about the evidence that the grand jury reviewed. Violation of Federal Criminal Rule 6E could lead to a prison sentence or an indefinite prison sentence based on the mood of the presiding judge. In a conversation with his attorney, Karen Balcani, the Colorado native explained his motivation this way. He said, "This isn't about them and it isn't about me. This is about how the government works. And it's no use going halfway and showing how you can't trust government to do nuclear stuff because they lie. And if you don't go the rest of the way and show that they can't trust or you can't trust the government to enforce the laws either because they lie, it's the same issue, it's the same problem. And if people aren't held accountable for what they do, then the system simply will break down. It cannot work. And I have to be accountable for what I do too," McKinley stressed, "or what I don't do. And maybe this is just a little bit of accountability, but it's better than nothing." Author Balcani adds, "The Citizens Grand Jury investigation isn't just about Rocky Flats. It isn't just about a Justice Department cover-up. The government has plans to turn toxic and hazardous waste sites throughout the entire nation into recreation areas, and they say they'll clean them up. But after you hear the evidence of the cover-up at Rocky Flats, then you can better decide whether you can believe what the government says about how it cleans up its own toxic mess." Clearly, as Arjun Makagini, president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, points out in his afterword, quote, "This book with its real cowboy protagonist, a cowboy who knows mathematics, and its courageous FBI agent, and its Rocky Flats whistleblower, is far more than a cautionary tale. It is a true story of public empowerment based on solid research and told with style and vigor. If we pay no heed to its message, then we risk sliding down a steep slope into the nuclear abyss. But should we be awake enough to attend to it, we will surely be moved to put people back in the saddle and nuclear weapons where they belong, in the dustbin of history." Now, nuclear plant safety from a distance, the flaws at home and safety issues. The U.S. finds flaws, not crimes, at a nuclear site in Washington state. And the Bush administration is using legislative maneuvers to avoid nuclear waste cleanup. Cited from the Washington Post, this article comes from the Calamity Howler, and you can get a subscription. It's free. It's email to avkrebs@earthlink.net. That, again, is email to avkrebs@earthlink.net to receive. Just send your name and address. I suggest a donation of $10 a month for your subscription. But if you don't send anything, Krebs will send it to you free. Now, in Richland, Washington, using the nation's largest and leakiest nuclear waste dump as a backdrop, Senator Maria Cantwell, she's a Democrat from Washington, complained last week that the Bush administration is using legislative maneuvers to avoid cleaning up Cold War-era poisons that are tainting underground water and oozing into the Columbia River. And they're trying to create a loophole in the definition of nuclear waste big enough to drive a truck through and leave Washington State to deal with the mess that we don't want, Cantwell said, echoing the worries of state environmental officials who helped monitor the federal Hanford Nuclear Reservation here in Washington State. Now, Cantwell's complaint will animate a debate expected this week on the Senate floor. She and Senator Ernest F. Hollings, he's a Democrat from South Carolina, plan to lead an effort to strip language out of the defense authorization bill that would allow the Energy Department to leave some radioactive waste in buried tanks rather than get it up and ship it off for entombment down in Nevada. The fight over nuclear waste, which involves Washington, Idaho, and South Carolina, has slowed debate on the nearly $450 billion annual defense bill, which pays for everything from Iraq to the multi-billion dollar weapons systems. Now, a vote on the Cantwell-Hollings amendment would be close, with Democrats lining up solidly against the Bush administration. Cantwell and her supporters say that they're courting several moderate Republicans who often vote against the administration, especially on environmental issues. The Energy Department maintains that it could save more than $85 billion while avoiding the risk of deaths and injuries to cleanup workers if they were allowed to leave the last remnants of nuclear waste in underground tanks and then seal it in place with a special kind of concrete. It is crazy to classify all of the waste from nuclear bomb production throughout the Cold War as high level when a small fraction of that nuclear waste can be safely stored in existing tanks, said Kyle McSlero. He's the Deputy Secretary of Energy. We want to do this, not to them, but with them, said McSlero, referring to the three states with major cleanup projects underway at old bomb-making sites. And there's considerable disagreement about how dangerous the last remnants of waste are. Cantwell and such groups as the Nature Resource Defense Council point to studies showing that up to half the radioactivity in an underground tank can be contained in the sludge residue at the bottom of the tank. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Well, people call the law school regularly, and they ask how they can learn more about the topics that I speak on over the air. Now, remember that every topic that I cover on the air, I teach in detail in one of my classes. These classes are tailored for busy people in every walk of life, people just like you. Now, for example, when we talk about the origin of the common law, how is that common law applicable today? How do we use the common law in court, on the street, at home, at work? Where did it come from, and what value is it now in the 21st century? Well, the common law is important because it affects your status, and your status is how you're being taxed. And it's important because it affects your property, or your lack of property. Now, this common law lesson is the first lesson of 46 lessons in my tax and status school, and we have three basic goals. First, we want to help you stay out of jail. That makes sense. Two, we want to help you save your assets. And three, we want to help you solve your tax problem once and for all time. Now, if you want to live your life peaceably and be left alone, then this tax and status school is for you. You can write, call, or wire me, George Gordon, and ask for my free general law CD package. That's the place to start. And I'll show you why the common law is so important to you and in so many different ways. Now, for more information about my tax and status school, why don't you just call and order the free general law CD package first. That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. And it's educational, informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free of charge. And you can call right now. The number's 417-273-4967 to order yours. And remember, my tax and status school is also available now on compact disc for adult home study. If you can't come to school, we'll bring the school to you. And if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine, and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. A federal court in Idaho last year ruled against an earlier effort by the Energy Department to keep some waste in the aging tanks rather than moving it to Nevada for burial beneath Yucca Mountain. Because of that ruling, which is under appeal, McSlero said that his department urgently needs new language in the defense bill or we can't spend money to continue the cleanup. Cantwell has called this blackmail. Here along the Columbia River, Hanford is by far the largest of the cleanup sites. Now, once the primary factory for making weapons-grade plutonium, this site at Hanford, Washington, stores about two-thirds of the country's high-level nuclear waste, and it's kept in 177 underground tanks. A third of these tanks have been leaking for decades, and Hanford is bordered by the Columbia River, the largest river in the West. The leaks have tainted groundwater, creating a slowly expanding 80-square-mile plume of contamination that violates federal water quality standards. This plume abuts the Columbia River and is a risk to the water supply for Richland, where many scientists and bureaucrats employed in the $2 billion a year Hanford cleanup now live. Last month, the Energy Department persuaded Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, to introduce language into the defense bill that would allow South Carolina to entomb in concrete and sand some of the waste left over from the bomb building operations at the Savannah River nuclear site near Aiken, South Carolina. In this, Graham has the support of the governor and state health and environmental officials in his home state. The Energy Department had tried but failed to get similar support from state officials in Washington and Idaho. A key issue is the extent to which the federal government can order states to do its bidding. Graham has insisted that South Carolina will retain final control over cleanup decisions. Most of the waste, he noted, would be shipped to a permanent repository planned for Nevada. I'd never do this unless my state encouraged me to do it, Graham said, and I wouldn't do this for a second if I was going to jeopardize groundwater. But his Senate colleague from South Carolina disagrees. This is monkey shine, said Senator Hollings. He said that on the Senate floor last month. He warned that the tanks were near a major earthquake fault line and could leak into the Tuscaloosa aquifer or the Savannah River. What particularly upsets Cantwell about the proposal to reclassify waste is that it was inserted into the defense bill without public hearings and without going through the Senate committee that oversees the Energy Department. This is a very serious policy change that they're trying to make through closed-door meetings, she said. Have you heard of Ralph Nader? Nader's running for president again. He did that last round. Democrats are squealing like gutshot banshees about Nader running for president. If there's one thing that the establishment doesn't want, it's for a Nader to become president. That's impossible, of course. The mainstream media backs Republicans and Democrats. Everybody listens to mainstream media, so everybody votes for Republicans or Democrats. But the libelous anti-Nader material that the Democrats are now running on television ads and on the internet could well backfire. You see, normally when you're trying to win over a constituency, you try to be nice to them. But in the case of the Nader voters, the Democrats have been conducting a four-year hate campaign against Nader that has gained in intensity. At least it has in the current race. The underlying message is this: you're so stupid that you voted for Nader. Now, that's not particularly nuanced toward politics, now, is it? And unfortunately, however, the Democrats, especially liberals, have increasingly stigmatized those with whom they disagree on some issue, thus reducing their constituency with little chance of winning it back. Now, the voters being insulted by the Hate Nader campaign join people like gun owners, fundamentalists, Southerners, and abortion opponents as among those rejected by the Democrats, even though they were once a key part of the Democratic Party constituency. Meanwhile, just as was true in 2000, the Nader support is not behaving the way the liberal Democrats would have you believe. For example, John Kerry just lost 11 points in Minnesota polling, but the Nader vote didn't change at all. And also, while Nader is showing strength in some expected states, such as California, he's also doing better than expected in places like Indiana and South Dakota. And why is that? Well, because, despite the stereotype, the Nader support comes from a variety of sources, such as the Greens, the ex-Perot backers, the generally pissed off, and those just who wouldn't just vote without Nader in the race. Now, the best plan for the Democrats would be to cancel their Hate Nader campaign and adopt some of his positions so that his supporters might have a reason to back Kerry. Now, as it is, the Democrats are just acting mean and dumb. Have you heard of the Iraqi Prime Minister? His name is Alawi, A-L-L-A-W-I. Well, the new Iraqi Prime Minister Alawi, responsible for claim of the weapons of mass destruction, which could be operational in just 45 minutes. Remember, our intelligence on Iraq came from these Iraqi dissidents, the anti-Saddam Hussein clique, living in the United States and being supported by taxpayers. The CIA got their information from these boys. And then when it was all said and done, there were no weapons of mass destruction in Chalabi, who the United States was backing and had planned to put in as prime minister. They arrested and seized his material, cut off his stipend or his allowance, claiming that he is an Iranian spy. Somehow we just keep shooting ourselves in the foot, don't we? Well, this guy, Alawi, the choice of Ayed Alawi, closely linked to the CIA and formerly to M16 as the prime minister of Iraq from 30 June will make it difficult for the U.S. and Britain to persuade the rest of the world that he's capable of leading an independent government. He's the person through whom the controversial claim was channeled that Iraqi weapons of mass destruction could be operational in 45 minutes. Dr. Alawi, age 59, who trained as a neurologist, is a Shia Muslim who was a member of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party in Iraq and in Britain, where he was a student leader with links to Iraqi intelligence, and he later moved into opposition to the Iraqi leader and reportedly established a connection with the British security services. So he became a British spy. His change of allegiance led to Dr. Alawi being targeted by Iraqi intelligence in 1978. Their agents, armed with knives and axes, badly wounded him when they attacked him as he lay asleep in bed in his house in Kingston upon Thames. Dr. Alawi became a businessman with contacts in Saudi Arabia. He was charming, intelligent, and had a gift for impressing Western intelligence agencies. After the 1991 Gulf War, the Iraq National Accord, that is the INA party, which he helped to found, became one of the building blocks for the Iraqi opposition in exile. The organization attracted former Iraqi army officers and Ba'ath party officials, particularly Sunni Arabs fleeing Iraq. In the mid-1990s, the INA claimed to have extensive contacts in the Iraqi officer corps. Dr. Alawi began to move from the orbit of M16 to the CIA, and he persuaded his new masters that he was in a position to organize a military coup in Baghdad. So with American, British, and Saudi support, he opened a headquarters and radio station in Amman, Jordan in 1996, declaring it was a historic moment for the Iraqi opposition. After a failed coup attempt that year were made, mass arrests were made in Baghdad. Abdul Karim al-Kabiri, the Jordanian prime minister of the day, said that INA's networks were all permitted by the Iraqi security services. Dr. Alawi and the INA returned to Iraq after the fall of Saddam and set up offices in Baghdad and in old Ba'ath party offices throughout Iraq. There were few signs that they had any popular support during an uprising in the town of Baji, north of Baghdad last year, and crowds immediately set fire to the INA office. Dr. Alawi was head of the Security Committee of the Iraqi Governing Council and was opposed to the dissolution of the Iraqi army by Paul Bremer, the U.S. Viceroy in Iraq. Now, he stepped down in protest as head of the committee during the U.S. assault on Fallujah, but his reputation among Iraqis for working first with Saddam's intelligence agents and then with M16 and the CIA may make it impossible for them to accept him as their leader of an independent Iraq. All right, you're listening to The Law. We're an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, when people call the law school and ask how they can learn more about the topics that I speak on over the air, keep in mind that most of the topics that you hear on the radio, I teach in detail in one of my classes here at the law school. For example, when you hear me talking about the common law, it was Alfred the Great who codified the common law back in 872 A.D. He codified it into 49 principles or statutes, of which 22 were incorporated into our Constitution and our Bill of Rights. The common law was taken from the Mosaic law given to Moses at Mount Sinai. It's recorded in Exodus 19:16 through Exodus 24, verse 8, and it includes negligence, insurance, and taxes, such as income, property, and social security taxes. Now, these IRS tax laws are a counterfeit of the tithing laws of Scripture, and they work a theft on everyone who participates in them. Now, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob gave us a better way of life than income tax and social security, and that's the basis of my tax and status school. We owe this income tax and the social security tax because we've contracted into it. I contend it's time to contract out of it. Now, if you'd like to learn more about tax and status, why don't you just write for my free general law CD package? It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free of charge. And you can order yours by simply calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to the website and send me an email. That's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. There's a little piece that comes out of Iraq, just in case you didn't know. The Iraqis are buying gasoline for 5 cents a gallon, while you're paying $2 a gallon. Now, that's a pretty good story, isn't it? You know, while Americans are shelling out nearly record prices for fuel, the Iraqis pay only 5 cents a gallon for gasoline. It's a benefit of hundreds of millions of dollars a year in subsidies bankrolled by American taxpayers. Back before the war, some forecasters predicted that by invading Iraq and ousting Saddam Hussein, America would benefit from increased exports of oil from Iraq, which was the world's second largest petroleum reserves. The result, according to those forecasts, would be cheaper gas for American motorists and a boost for the oil-dependent American economy. Well, now, more than a year after the invasion, that logic has been flipped on its head. Now, the price for gasoline in the United States is averaging $2 a gallon, 50 cents more than the pre-invasion price. The only people getting cheap gas as a result of the invasion are the Iraqis. Filling a 22-gallon tank in Baghdad with low-grade fuel costs $1.10, plus a 50-cent tip for the attendant. A tank full of high test costs $2.75. In Britain, by contrast, gasoline prices hit $5.79 a gallon last week. That's $127 for that same tank full of gasoline. Now, although Iraq is a major petroleum producer, the country has little capacity to refine its own gasoline. So the U.S. government pays $1.50 a gallon to buy fuel in neighboring countries and then deliver that fuel to the Iraqi service stations. A three-month supply costs American taxpayers more than $500 million. Now, that's a half a billion. You know, before long, we'll be talking about real money. And that doesn't include the cost of military escorts to fend off attacks by Iraqi insurgents against these fuel trucks moving up and down Iraqi's highways. The arrangement keeps a fleet of 4,200 tank trucks constantly on the move, ferrying fuel to Iraq. We want to thank the Americans, Baghdad taxi driver Osama Hisham, he's 26 years old, said, as he topped off the tank of his beat-up 1983 Volkswagen. They risked their lives to liberate us, and now they're improving our lives with 5 cents a gallon gas. Iraq's fuel subsidies, which are intended to mollify drivers used to low-priced fuel under Saddam Hussein, have coupled with the opening of the borders to create an anarchic car culture. I don't know what that word is. Anarchic? Anachronic, I think, would be better, or something of that nature. Anyway, that's the culture in Baghdad. Cheap used cars shipped from Europe and Asia are flooding into Iraq. A 10-year-old BMW in good condition costs just $5,000. Since gas is so cheap, anyone with a car can become a taxi driver. Drivers jam the streets, offering rides for as little as 250 dinars. That's about 17 cents. Iraq has no sales tax. They have no registration fees. They have no license plates and no auto insurance. And some people would argue there are no rules of the road. Cars barrel along the wrong way on the highway. They swoop into surprise U-turns. They ignore traffic signals. Analysts say the U.S. gas subsidies cannot last forever. The Iraqis may be in for an unpleasant shock when they end. And in the meantime, however, the American taxpayer continues to foot this huge bill. The U.S. taxpayer has a right to be indignant. The Iraqis have to be warned about the long-run damages of this kind of subsidy, said Anthony Kordsman. He's an Iraq analyst with the Washington, D.C.-based Center for Strategic and International Studies. The minute the aid goes out, or the minute we stop the aid, the party is over, and there's going to be a hell of a hangover. The cheap fuel is spurring unsustainable demand, promoting wasteful use of energy and transportation, and squandering Iraq's oil output that might otherwise be exported, Kordsman said. You're leading people to buy cars that aren't affordable at normal costs, he said, and you need to move toward real market prices as quickly as you can without causing instability. Iraqi drivers protest that the price difference between a gallon of gas in the U.S. and Iraq is fair because the average Iraqi earns around $1,000 per year, a 13th of the average U.S. income. If the price of gas goes up, we'll see lots of anger in the street, said cab driver Hisham at a grimy filling station on Saddam Street in central Baghdad. Cheap gasoline is also needed to fuel the ubiquitous portable electric generators which power air conditioners during long daily electricity blackouts in Iraq. Hisham and another driver, convinced like many Iraqis that the U.S. reaps huge amounts of cheap Iraqi oil, said subsidized gasoline was the least America could provide in return for all of this cheap Iraqi crude oil being exported to America. Now, the United States controls all Iraqi resources now, said Gene Jabrow, 50, filling up his Opel. So what if they have to pay a little bit for gasoline? That's nothing compared to what they get in return. Analysts say that there never was a good case that a U.S. invasion would pay dividends in cheap oil. Some of the neoconservatives might have been saying that, but no energy analysts were walking around saying that, Kordsman said. Iraq's current exports of just under 2 million barrels of oil a day are not enough to dent the world market price. It will take up to 3 years to bring Iraq back just to its 1991 export level, or so said Rachel Brunson of the Council on Foreign Relations. Well, it's nice to know that the Iraqis don't have any registration or insurance fees, get 5 cents a gallon of gas. I'm very happy for the Iraqis. I'm not very happy here at home. Well, we got Bush's Democratic charade in Iraq. Let's see what else is going on over there in Iraq land. This is an article from Jim Tarbell and Roger Burback, Imperial Overstretch. Remember, this is published in the Calamity Howler. If you'd like to get a free subscription, just send an email to avkrebs@earthlink.net. It's an easy one. Email avkrebs@earthlink.net to receive. Send your name and address. We get this on the out of the email machine. Now, Krebs, I'm going to give him a little boost here. I don't get paid for doing this, and I do this as a public service. We get paid by students that go to school here. But our objective is to inform the public as to what's going on around them so that you can make better informed decisions. After all, that's what life is all about, making decisions. And oftentimes, the decisions we make aren't so good. But I think that a subscription to the Calamity Howler or the Agribusiness Examiner, either or, you can get both. The Agribusiness Examiner comes out once a week, as does the Calamity Howler, published by A.V. Krebs, and you can subscribe by simply going to the email avkrebs@earthlink.net. To receive, simply send your name and address. Krebs asks for donations at the end of the newsletter each and every time. I suggest a donation of $10 a month. That's $120 a year. I think it's well worth $10 a month. I don't know of another newsletter that's as good or as cheap as the Calamity Howler and the Agribusiness Examiner. And he's not asking for a subscription price. He says, you pay me what you think it's worth. If you think it's worth a dollar, pay a dollar. If you think it's worth nothing, give him nothing. In November of 2003, with U.S. soldiers facing mounting casualties in the search for weapons of mass destruction, largely abandoned, George W. Bush appeared before the National Endowment for Democracy. It's a quasi-public institution set up to advance U.S. political objectives abroad. And there on the endowment's 20th anniversary, Bush proclaimed a new rationale for the occupation of Iraq. He said it's to build a democracy. Now, I thought it was for the purposes of fighting terrorism, and then I thought it was for the purposes of stopping weapons of mass destruction from being used on us, and now, as I guess I understand it, we went into Iraq so that we could build democracy there. Couldn't we make the same case for North Korea or the Sudan or any other country in the world that's occupied by a dictator? Anyway, a democracy that will send forth the news from Damascus to Tehran. I guess we're going to build a democracy so that we can send a message. I'd kind of prefer if we had $1.50 gas here to 5-cent gas in Baghdad. Of course, that's just my own personal view. You're listening to The Law Hour, and the editorial review was sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, the income tax and Social Security programs are not compatible with our traditional American values, and that's because these two programs are the second and the eighth planks of the Communist Manifesto, which is the bottom rung to the New World Order. These programs call for a heavy progressive income tax in place of tithing. Social Security is a social welfare scheme that takes the place of strict liability and individual responsibility. The income tax requires of us that we serve two masters in violation of Matthew 6, verse 24. The income tax requires of us that we rob God in violation of Malachi 3, verse 8. This income tax requires of us that we commit idolatry in violation of Exodus 20, verse 3. And this income tax requires of us that we use unjust weights and balances in violation of Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. This income tax requires of us that we sign contracts with foreign and alien gods called government, and that in violation of Exodus 23, verses 32 and 33. Social Security violates the strict liability statute in Exodus 21, verses 28 through 36, and Social Security violates the 10th commandment by appealing to our lust and greed. We're then taught to call that income redistribution. The scripture calls it covetousness and theft in violation of Exodus 20, verses 15 and 17. Well, you know, the God of Israel gave us a better way of life than that, and our founding fathers followed a better way of life than income tax and Social Security, and that's why I contend that you and I ought to learn how to practice that better way of life. If you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call me? The number's 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary. A four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. This tax and status school, by the way, is available on compact disc for adult home education. You can come to school here at the law school, or we'll take the law school to you at home. And if you're online, why don't you go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email, send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, it's free of charge. And that address is georgegordon.org. Click onto the email when you get there. Or you can call direct 417-273-4967. Well, why are we in Iraq? Well, we're there to build democracy. Now, 7 months later, with the formation of the Iraqi interim government and the operation or the opening of the largest U.S. embassy compound in the world. The largest embassy in the world is going to be there in Baghdad. Not Russia, not China, Baghdad. And it has become apparent just what kind of democracy the United States is foisting off on Iraq and the Arab world. It's going to be a democracy with controlled elections, a representative state security apparatus, and a free market. a free market economy that favors U.S. interests and the Iraqi economic elite. Well, they're going to get the same thing there that we've got here, but with lower taxes. Now, the two key figures anointed to carry out this democratic charade are the leader of the interim government, Iyad Alawi, and the U.S. Ambassador, John Negroponte. Their backgrounds and credentials can hardly be described as democratic. And much has been made in recent days of the alleged friction between the United States and the Iraqi interim government. This is largely staged. It's an effort to give the impression to Iraqis and the world that the new government has some legitimacy. Iyad Alawi, while publicly pushing for more autonomy, is closely aligned with the United States and has been on the CIA payroll for many years. He confirmed his dependence on the U.S. agenda and the occupation army when, upon being nominated as prime minister, he proclaimed, "We need the support of the multinational forces." So with the aid of the British and American intelligence services, Alawi founded the Iraqi National Accord in 1990. That was an exiled group comprised largely of Ba'athist and military officers who defected from Saddam. Clinton and the CIA provided extensive support to the accord and its failed attempts to carry out a palace coup by military officers close to Saddam back in the 1990s. As the Bush administration ramped up for war in the summer of 2002, Alawi took part in high-level Pentagon and State Department planning and briefing sessions. Alawi finally returned to Iraq with the invading U.S. Army after living abroad for more than 30 years. Hardly an on-the-scenes Iraqi leader, now is he? As a reward for his collaboration, J. Paul Bremer appointed Alawi to the Iraqi Governing Council, and there he focused on running the Council's Security Committee, which was responsible for building up the new Iraqi Army, Police, and Intelligence Services. The New York Times quotes one observer as saying, "Iyad is somebody who is militarily minded, and he wants a strong government, and he believes in a strong army, especially a strong army sponsored by the United States." Now, Mary Curtis of the Los Angeles Times adds, "To those who want to build a democratic future on Iraq's authoritarian past, Alawi's record may be worrisome. Like his American sponsors, Alawi is committed to a neoliberal market economy. The Iraqi National Accord promotes giving permission to the private sector to participate in all economic activities and giving permission to the free market to specify the direction of those economic activities. Alawi and the interim government will operate under economic guidelines put into place by the Coalition Provisional Authority and the Iraqi Governing Council. Decrees for the privatization of all sectors of the economy remain in effect. As well as the opening of the economy to foreign investment, members of independent regulatory bodies appointed by J. Paul Bremer cannot be removed by the new ministers of this interim government, and Alawi himself comes from the Shiite merchant class of Iraq that would be among the primary beneficiaries of this new U.S.-imposed economic order." The Washington Post points out that with their links to the bazaars of Persia, the prominent Shiite families were often far wealthier and more cultivated than the Sunnis, who predominated under Saddam's rule. Alawi has wasted no time in taking advantage of the new economic conditions. During his tenure on the Iraqi Governing Council, rumors abounded of corruption and influence peddling, including accusations that he collected commissions to deliver government contracts. Alawi's powerful overseer in Baghdad, U.S. Ambassador-designate John Negroponte, has been on the cutting edge in preserving and advancing the interests of the U.S. empire for many years. From 1971 to 73, Negroponte served as the officer in charge of Vietnam on the National Security Council. In the 1980s, he became the U.S. ambassador in the pivotal Central American country of Honduras as the United States masterminded wars against a popular democracy in Nicaragua to the south and against a popular liberation movement in El Salvador to the west. From his embassy post in Tegucigalpa, Negroponte first became known as the Imperial Proconsul, a title that he carries with him to Baghdad. In Honduras, he managed the largest CIA station in the world and oversaw an increase in Honduran military aid from $3.9 million a year to $77.4 million a year. And he supervised the construction of military bases and the transfer of resources to the U.S.-financed surrogate army fighting the Nicaraguan government. And befitting the role he will play in Baghdad, he turned a blind eye to the torture and abuse performed by Honduran death squads that disappeared to critics of America's wars in Central America. The Council on Hemispheric Affairs, a Washington-based research and information center, says that John Negroponte is preeminently an ends justifies the means operator. Journalist Tony Solo has called him the Teflon torture manager. As U.S. ambassador to the United Nations under Bush, he faithfully strong-armed nations into supporting America's preemptive war in Iraq, and he oversaw an intelligence operation that included bugging the phones of allies and adversaries alike. The new U.S. embassy in Baghdad, constructed on the site of one of Saddam's palaces, will have a staff of 1,500 Americans and an equal number of Iraqis. It'll be protected by U.S. soldiers as well as private contractors, with over 100 armored vehicles inside the walls of the embassy compound, and the strategy of the occupation forces will be plotted along with the construction of 14 U.S. military bases around the country. Embassy personnel will work throughout all 32 ministries of the interim government, with one key advisor serving as the counterpart to every minister. Special attention will be paid to the oil ministry, which will be headed by Thamar Gadhan, who was originally appointed to the same post by the United States in May of 2003. In that position, he worked closely with an advisory committee headed by a former head of Shell Oil Company. Now, while Negroponte's embassy is managing the military and oil aspects of the Iraqi situation, the National Endowment for Democracy, the NED, is orchestrating the democratic operation. But democracy at the NED is by no means a popular democracy with broad participation. Instead, the NED promotes a top-down controlled democracy in which the elites govern and the popular classes are only given token participation at election time. Meanwhile, private economic power reigns supreme. The National Endowment for Democracy grew out of the post-Vietnam era, the need to attain U.S. national interests without depending solely on coercive military force, at a time when the CIA had been embarrassed by intervening in foreign elections. The NED was developed as a quasi-private institution to carry out interventionist political policies beyond congressional inspection. Well, he has a lot of good experience down in Nicaragua, doesn't he? And the Iran-Contra affair. Well, so much for the stories on Iraq. That'll keep us up to date on Iraq, at least for the moment. We'll be back with more tomorrow night, same time, same station. We're just about out of time. Let me remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour and the Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School in Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network and worldwide on the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Gordon Law School and the Law Hour, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Gordon Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it's open to individuals by prearrangement only. The Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule of archives that can be accessed through my website at georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Well, there's the signal. It says our time is up. We'll have to leave it right there. And I'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing. So until then, good night, friends.